Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite Magazine's new e-zines. It's a simple way to stay connected to the topics and events you care about most. Daily content on arts, culture, food, design, style, green living, and much more can be delivered to your inbox. Registration is available at urbanitebaltimore.com. We are now joined by Dr. Zeynep Tufekci, assistant professor at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, in the Department of Sociology and Anthropology. Her blog is www.technosociology.org. And we're about to talk about all these things we've been reading about in the papers lately that are really diverse in some ways and figure out how they're connected. We'll talk about that here. And let me first introduce you to our guest, Zeynep. Welcome back. It's good to have you with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
That's always great to have you on the air. Even though we can't see you, it's good to have you here. So I know you're a very busy human being.
We are hoping eventually to make that connection happen.
It will happen. It will happen. In this last week, in some weeks, we've seen a lot of things go on, and they're really very complex. I mean, when you figure out how the interaction of this. First, there was the United Nations declares that Internet access is a human right.
Yes.
Then you see that the International Monetary Fund was hacked, most likely by a foreign government.
Right.
And then we see all these other hackings that have gone on around the country, around the globe, whether it was huge companies like Google and Sony and others who have been hacked into, and then you have the United States now underwriting internet campaigns or detours around the world to help democracy activists get access when countries like Syria and other places close them down. And then Anonymous, who attacked after WikiLeaks was being attacked by governments, they attacked banks and governments, and Anonymous arrests were allegedly made in Spain and in your homeland of Turkey.
Correct.
So it's all very – this is complex, but in some ways all intertwined, it seems to me.
Yes, it is. I mean, certainly Internet has become a part of our new commons, right? It's a place where – all sorts of activities ranging from just social interaction to complex financial transactions take place. And as such, I see the United Nations Declaration kind of like an extension of the idea that we have a right to free speech, a right to assembly, just kind of extending it to this new reality rather than recognizing something completely new. Because, for example, think about right to free speech. Well, without access to the means of speech, it's not as meaningful, right? You can always talk to yourself in the bathroom. That's not really what I think people mean when they say you have a right to free speech. It means you have a right to communicate with people. And for better or worse, the Internet is a primary means now in the 21st century of how we communicate with people. So see it just as a natural extension of the right to assembly, right to communicate. So to me, that was, yes, recognition of a reality. Now, all these other parts of what you're talking about are a reflection of the fact that the Internet is this complex technological space, which isn't really designed, if you go back to its origins, for security and for sort of keeping things secret and closed, but it's more designed for connectivity, and it's just a protocol anyway. And the protocol wasn't designed for a world where you have these hostile attacks for, you know, whether you agree or disagree with them. It was designed for a bunch of academics and other people who kind of just wanted to communicate with each other.
Right.
So they didn't really build these huge safeguards into it. In fact, it is on purpose kind of an open system. So unless you're careful with it, plus the systems we have aren't very secure, it's open to this, and which is what brings up all these issues of hacking and attacks. And some people have argued, and I can see the point, that it's almost like some of these protests are kind of like the modern civil disobedience, right? Sort of going to websites and saying, oh, we are against whatever your cause might be at the moment. That might be seen as a form of blocking something like civil disobedience. On the other hand, that, of course, brings up all the questions of civil disobedience. When is it justified? When can you block something? When can you block an entrance? I think it's kind of the same question. It's very. It's the new reality. It's with us to stay.
But it seems that this is. There are a couple things here that are very complex, I think, to me. And you can join us here, by the way, folks, at 410-319-8888. First of all, the idea that the United Nations declared access to the internet as mm-hmm. a human right. Mm-hmm. Well, here we live in a country where there's a lot of places where there's not access to the internet, even in the United
Correct.
States of America, let alone throughout the rest of the world, and the developing
Correct.
World especially. This might have been, A, motivated in part by the Arab Spring, but also motivated by people's support of WikiLeaks being allowed to do what they do. You know?
Right. I mean, sometimes you do see this, especially the U.S. State Department has been kind of in this position where, on the one hand, it has this, you know, we support internet freedom, but the danger there is that it'll just be seen as an extension of things that the U.S. wants and not things that U.S. does not want. For example, a U.S. ally, Bahrain, has been carrying out a pretty brutal crackdown against these protesters. Very brutal, horrible methods. But the Fifth Fleet is there, and bloggers are being jailed. So you see what I'm saying? There's no way to have a net freedom policy only without talking about its political consequences. As I like to say, internet's not your pony, that it's only going to do the tricks you'd like to do. It might end up destabilizing, you know, countries, autocracies, pretty nasty dictatorship in the case of Bahrain, that are actually our friends, unfortunately, or Saudi Arabia, or, you know, such countries. But I think for U.S. foreign policy, it has to come to terms with its own contradictions between things we say and not always apply when it's not convenient. And that also plays out in the case of questions of internet freedom, because internet freedom is not only blocked in countries that the U.S. is not in good relationships with, say, Iran, but also in places where all our Fifth Fleet is, like Bahrain.
Mm-hmm.
So that's good old politics and all the problems of not, you know, kind of state-based policies where you have a gap between your values and sometimes your behavior, in fact, more than often.
But it's also with a certain skill set that people have. It's almost like this, that we're beginning to see both warfare, political resistance, and crime all in the cyber world.
Yes,
I mean,
absolutely.
It's all exploding. I mean, when Citibank, Citigroup is hacked into, and personal details of 210,000 cardholders were stolen. And a security breach of Citi's web portal. I mean, that's huge.
That is very huge. That is unfortunate. And the worst part is that as sort of citizens, we seem to be without recourse. I mean, I get basically a couple times a year, I get a letter from a credit card company saying, oh, sorry, all your information was breached, and here are new numbers, and that's it.
Right. Right.
That's all I get in the mail. And I get this a couple of times a year. So I'm guessing, you know, this happens to everybody. And there might be real consequences, because that might mean my personal information is in the hands of who knows what. And most of the time, it just means that somebody's trying to steal money from me. But what if somebody's stalking you? What if somebody's trying to, you know, find you, and there's all these sort of ways in which they can find someone who's maybe hiding from an abusive ex-spouse or something like that. So that's what I think about when I hear all these breaches. You know, for me, it's not that big a deal because, well, frankly, if my credit card is defrauded because of Citibank, it should be their problem. Yes, I know identity theft could be a huge headache, but there could be cases in which this is a matter of life and death. And in the case of some of the hackings, we know governments have tried to hack into accounts of dissidents. We've seen this again and again in China. We've seen this during the uprisings in the Middle East. I'm sure that's happening in Syria. In which case, the hacking means that somebody's life is in danger. So insecure systems aren't just an inconvenience. They could really mean the difference between life and death for someone. And that remains a huge unsolved problem because the infrastructure of the internet and the way Windows machines, which are 90% of the computers, are set up, it's just not secure, and that's just the reality.
Would it be any more secure if people used Apple?
Not necessarily. Not necessarily. necessarily, but I mean, as a programmer, Windows operating system is notoriously not very well designed in terms of security. Plus, the internet is not designed to keep things closed. It's a protocol that is based on trust between the nodes in the network rather than this kind of malicious attacks.
But it's even in this country. I mean, the trial that was supposed to come this week of Thomas Drake, who former computer expert at the National Security Agency, who was saying one of the things he leaked to the press was that the NSA was using their abilities to monitor emails, millions and millions of emails from all across, not the around the world that you're supposed to, but in America.
Yes. This is where I would really like the State Department, who really has these great principles on what governments should not do to other people's, their own citizens, to talk to the NSA and tell them not to do those things to us either, because there's increasingly reports. There's one today that, FBI is now just considering no big deal to snoop through certain digital traces.
Right.
There's this complete erosion of Fourth Amendment protections online. And I think what law enforcement is thinking is, oh, wait, we got a means to get the bad guys, and they're just sort of forging ahead. But that's why you need checks and balances. You need probable cause. And in fact, the law enforcement, if you told them, look, what you're doing is you're going into somebody's house, opening their drawer and reading their letters. That requires a warrant. That's what, when you're, accessing an email online without a warrant, that's in effect what you're doing. But we don't. They are inclined not to think of it that way. And as far as I can tell, Congress has really been really behind in helping ordinary people keep their Fourth Amendment as part of our Constitution rights online. And I know we always say it's to catch the bad guys, but in a civilized society, there's certain things you don't do to catch the bad guys. And frankly, I think most of the bad guys are fairly well aware of encryption methods, so it's probably not that effective. But also, it comes at a cost to the kind of society we have if we, leave behind Fourth Amendment as soon as we enter the online world, because online world is now inseparable part and parcel of our social life, our political life, everything. I mean, I don't want the government of Bahrain to snoop on its own dissidents, and I don't want the United States government to look at emails without a warrant. If they have a warrant, if they have due process, by all means. Without it, I think that's just not right.
But we're also seeing, I think what is increasing here, by the way, folks, 410-319-8888 is the number, is the increasing use of this between governments and in cyber war, whether you watch the United States and Israel putting a virus into Iran's nuclear system, or China attacking Google, or any of the things we can mention here.
In fact, there was a recent story that it's not confirmed to be the Chinese government, but widely suspected that they use these phishing, which means they got people to click on email that really, really looked like it was from a friend, saying, oh, here's our meeting notes from our meeting last week, which really took place. It wasn't one of those. It was from somebody that you did meet with. So they'd done their, sort of homework. And then you clicked on it, and it looked like you had just logged out of Gmail in this very convincing Gmail login. Come on, and who hasn't been accidentally logged out of a website, right?
Right.
You just type it back in, and boom, they have access. And if you look back at how much information is there, someone has a list of everything you've done on your email. If you have, all your browser history, all your email, it's enormous. It's just enormous. And the reporting on the story said the people who were hacked were very high level. They weren't, some third, fourth level person, but people whose names would recognize. And whatever they were saying, presumably partly conducting, government business, now whoever hacked knows about this. And this is just, I think if there were more, the kind of secure systems that seem to, yes, it would make maybe it would stop law enforcement maybe from being able to access everything so easily either, but it might make us all safer if the whole tech industry and government and everybody kind of sat down and said, look, we have a problem. We cannot leave, you know, cyberspace as this completely unlocked place, because it also erodes trust. It creates problems. It creates hoaxes. There's got to be a better way to do this. But since it's technical, most of us go, oh, just, you know, I hope it doesn't happen to me. And we kind of look away. And it's fine until it does happen to you, you know?
Well, is there anything, I mean, are we entering a world where we have to realize that nothing is secure? That perhaps that what we even you know, that perhaps this new technology, the internet world we all live by every day, is the most least secure existence we've ever had.
Well, I hear what you're saying. Unfortunately, I don't think that would be very healthy for humanity if we lived in this world where you didn't have some expectation of privacy, some expectation of seclusion, some expectation to control your interactions and who it was visible to. I think that would be really unhealthy for our democracy. I mean, to be able to be a public person, you also need to have a private life. To be able to interact with people, you need to know that your interactions are taking place within a context rather than, you know, just going to be blown out of proportion when and if taken out of context. And that's what this is threatening to do to us. Now, yes, there are things you can do to try to make sure things are a little safer. And, yeah, for most of us, it doesn't matter because, you know, most of us, nobody cares about us, right? So we're ignored by everybody but, you know, some close family and your mom wants to know everything you're doing. But other than that, most people don't care. But that's not really what happens once you're, you know, thrust into the sort of spotlight. Think of the women that a couple of them who had been exchanging or were sent these inappropriate messages from our Congressman Wiener.
Yes, yes.
I'm just thinking about her, right? I mean, I don't even know if she did anything more than friend him or say something like, or follow him on Twitter and say something like, oh, I love your speeches, and got sent this picture, which was accidentally sent publicly instead of privately. And now she's in her 20s, in the middle of this storm, and everybody looking up stuff about her. It's just, it's crazy. The amount of things you can find out about her, and her life's been upended, and she hasn't done anything, but all her online footprints are there. This can happen. This has happened to younger people. You know, teenagers have found themselves in the spotlight like that. We need to develop better sort of ways, maybe etiquette. Maybe newspapers need to learn to lay off sort of reporting on the other side of the story. Somebody accidentally gets dragged into a story like this. I don't really know. I don't really have a solution. I just find it unhealthy.
Well, what I'm saying is I wonder if we are reaching a stage where this new world of ours, this new hyper-connected world that we're in, that's what we're in. I mean, the technology's there, and it's going to keep growing. It's not going to lessen. That we are in a world that now that is going to be less private, and our secrets and our worlds, things we want to keep to ourselves, are less secure.
Well, I think hyper-connected is a very good word for describing the situation. I think part of what is happening is a lot of people are developing various strategies to deal with it. You know, you might be not putting everything online, or you might be talking kind of in an obscure way so not everybody understands what you're saying except your friends. You might be very careful about computer security. I think people are struggling. I mean, we are entering that in some sense, but I don't really see that as, I mean, a lot of people say, oh, young people, they don't care. That, I don't really find that. In my research, I find that they've just been thrust into this world, and they're really struggling with how to maintain control over who they interact with and who they're visible to. And, you know, not always succeeding, but they're trying. They really are.
You know, when we look at this, and the possibility that cyber war could be very real.
Yes.
And I don't want to be on such a downer list of everything I'm saying here is negative, but cyber war could be very real. That could change the nature of how societies war against one another, and could affect us all. And that I'm not quite sure how people build other than build protections around any of that. Do you know?
Well, in terms of protections, obviously this is something. I mean, this is a new role for governments, is to maintain the security of all the critical systems that are partially dependent on online and internet-related interactions. And there are ways to do this. And don't get me wrong. I am not saying that it's technologically impossible. Not at all. There are ways to design secure systems, and that's what they should do. I mean, this should be a priority, and they should do that for whether it's the electrical grid or, you know, whatever else is involved in it. This is, I think, a key role for government. On the other hand, it should also stop taking advantage of all this data to erode Fourth Amendment. I really think that, you know, we need to bring citizens, make our government adapt to the new age, not in ways it just finds convenient, but in ways that are more beneficial to us as a society. And I think that involves both things, right? Not do this kind of surveillance, which is just easier now. I understand it's tempting. You know, you have all this data. It's sitting right there. And Congress hasn't done its job and provided proper Fourth Amendment. And you're thinking, oh, I'm just catching the bad guys. But that's not the way to do this. On the other hand, it needs to sit and think, you know what, maybe we are being a little lazy about how to keep these systems secure. It's possible they should do it because, I mean, just something like the electrical grid or the traffic light grid, these are not minor things. We live in a very fragile ecology, right? We all depend on everything else working to make things work. I'm just thinking about it. I mean, if supermarkets didn't work, I have mint on my front yard. I guess I could eat mint. That's the only thing I know how to grow. And that's only because mint is apparently a weed. So it just grows by itself. And then I'd have nothing else. So I depend on all these critical infrastructures to work to survive. And a lot of those infrastructures have components that are beyond my control. And this is where I think the public, the government, has a crucial role, and not leave it up to whatever the particular company thinks is good enough, but to set standards and say, this has to be done right. This is key to our society. Because, yes, we have all these, I mean, what you're saying is true. We have all these things happening so fast, and I don't think we're reacting fast enough.
And it's a very complex.
It is, absolutely.
Very complex. I mean, because the anonymous group that did all these attacks, they may have been found in Spain, and maybe they haven't, but they have this way of hiding themselves.
Yeah.
But you have places like the Syrian government and other governments who have a way of detecting anybody who sends out these messages on Facebook and then having them arrested.
It's all related. Yes, it's completely, absolutely all related. And this is the new world. This is the new world.
And
I said, I want State Department talk to NSA, and they want them both to listen to each other.
We're talking with Dr. Zeynep Tufekci, assistant professor at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, in the Department of Sociology and Anthropology. Her blog site, which is really great, is called technosociology.org. Our tools, ourselves.
And the mess we make with them.
And the mess we make with them.
And it's also exciting. I mean, it's also exciting. We get to meet people. We get, you know, people in another part of the world partially helped organize their revolutions against the dictators. I mean, I don't want to just sound all gloomy.
No, it's not. And you've done that.
Amazing. But they are not, you know, puppies and rainbows and everything and nothing else. They have all these dark sides and problems that come with it that require thinking and resources.
And
it's not going to fix itself.
And I just want to get people to your website. I think it's really great, technosociology.org. There's a whole lot there. And Zeynep, we'll be talking soon, and thank you so much.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Good to have you with us. We're going to take a short break in a minute or two. I want to remind you on the way to that break that the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com. Or go to steinershow.org and click on MeQ's banner. All the information is right there. We'll be right back. Stay with us.